Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 7th of December, Pearl Harbor Day. All things political, the first hour of our show, and our guest is Professor Alexander Lamis, Associate Professor of Political Science at the Department of Political Science, Case Western Reserve University. He's been with us many times. He's a specialist on elections and political parties, is the author of The Two-Party South, and has written various articles and book chapters on the politics of the American South. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we talk again, but there are always new developments on healthcare and Afghanistan and jobs and whatever you'd like to bring up. Second hour of our show today will be on Copenhagen, and the climate change conference that's taking place there. An interesting editorial in many newspapers all over the world today concerning climate change. So that will be the focus of our number two. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And I don't think we can do emails today. Our system is down. But you can call, right? Professor Lamis, hello. Welcome to the show again. Nice to talk to you.
Good morning.
Hi. Well, it's the same subjects we've been talking about for a long time. Let's start with Afghanistan. I thought the Times had an interesting article yesterday about how the president reached his decision, but still a lot of people aren't very happy about his decision, are they?
Well, no, that's right. I think a lot of the people who be in the left wing of the Democratic Party are really uneasy about where this policy is going to lead us. In fact, I heard your Senator Feingold, your senator, on a national program over the weekend, expressing a lot of skeptical thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, as has been said so often, that this could be a Vietnam for the president, or the circumstances, as he said, quite different than Vietnam?
Well, I think the circumstances are awfully different. I mean, you know, Vietnam was caught up in the midst of the Cold War struggle with the Soviet Union and Chinese involvement and all of that, which is easily forgotten. I mean, there were the domestic insurgent issues there, the civil war going on between the North and the South in Vietnam. But what concerns people is really, you know, what is our long-term strategy there, and that's where the Vietnam analogy comes into. Are we going to get stuck for a long period of time? And you know, related to that, of course, is this whole issue of what you do about Pakistan. And I don't know, you know, I'm sure you've noticed it. The administration clams up when Pakistan is raised, and they throw up the shield of, well, that's all secret stuff. You know, the CIA is waging that war for us, and we can't talk about it. And I would imagine a lot of people in the public are just confused because it's not being talked about, what's going on in Pakistan.
And do you think that that's really where the threat is? Are the people who are trying to get in Pakistan?
Well, it's obviously the two countries are related, and the border is porous, and you know they're not even sure where bin Laden is, whether he crosses the border. Sometimes he's in Afghanistan mountains, sometimes he's in the Pakistan mountains. And who knows, you know, what the state of al-Qaeda is there. Some experts on security policy say, well, al-Qaeda is a worldwide network now. They don't really need to be based in any one place. They're carrying out threats everywhere. Which, of course, diminishes the notion of you have to get them in this piece of property. So I think there's just a lot of questions. You know, I mean, I'm a supporter of, you know, President Obama, but I was disappointed in the way this has all been communicated. I mean, he gave a good speech at West Point, but it's not the kind of fireside chat with the American people that might be called for now. The way Roosevelt spoke to the general public on complicated issues, just laying it out in a very matter of fact way as to honestly what we're about in this policy area.
Right. He's usually very good at doing that, and the fact that you have questions and a lot of people have questions probably indicates that he fell short.
Well, I think so, and also that this is tough to determine the options, and I guess, you know, once they've made up their mind they want to go this way, they really don't want to spread out all the other options that they've discarded. and that, you know, may not be the best approach. It may have been better to, you know, lay out these things and get some public input as the decision-making process was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they got, you know, input from leaders in Congress and others in the administration, Vice President Biden and others. But we'll, you know, we'll see what, you know, what it looks like down the road. But there are just so many concerns being raised about this, about the Afghan political leadership and the whole nature of the society there. I mean, we can't get into providing nation building for many nations. It's just not, you know, it's just not feasible.
We did a show, time goes by so fast, maybe a month ago, that looked at the Pakistanis taking on the strongholds of terrorists in that border region. Do the Pakistanis have a strategy? Are we in consultation with them to make sure that they take some initiative here, a large initiative, in trying to root out terrorism on their border?
I don't think we know, really. I mean, the administration's people, when they talk about this, they're very cagey about it. They use this diplomatic speak. Well, we're bringing pressure. We're getting encouraging signs from the Pakistanis and so forth. But it's just not clear.
Right.
And there's so many elements to this that only the specialists, I think, really understand, average person could understand if you wanted to spend months studying. You know, there's the India part of the equation there that, that's not it's not completely clear to me, but that's part of it. And then there's the tribal rivalries and all of that.
Well, it's a large thing to do, to send that many troops into harm's way, isn't it? It's a very difficult decision. He is a smart guy who looks at all angles, but you also have to tell the American people why it's absolutely necessary.
I think so. You know, I just finished reading the new book called The Four Star. It's about the four top generals who shaped Iraq policy. And I learned a lot of great detail about what went on in Iraq and all the serious problems we had there, and that of course led to a lot of unnecessary loss of life, and being immersed in that makes me, you know, think, what's the Afghanistan version of the material reported in that book?
Right,
the Four Star.
Let's go to healthcare reform. I'm sure we'll return to Afghanistan as our listeners call in. The president dropped by yesterday as negotiations were going on. They still don't have 60 votes. I wonder where they are in terms of negotiation.
I don't know, but I'm optimistic that there will be a bill. I think it's in the interest of the Democratic majority to have a bill that has a lot of substance to it. So that means they're going to have to make compromises on the key issues like the public option and the whole abortion issue and other things. And I think they're capable of doing that among the senators and then between the two houses. But it's pretty clear that the leadership, the Democratic leadership in both houses, fully favors a strong piece of legislation.
And do you think, Professor Lamas, it can be a strong piece of legislation without a public option?
Well, I think it's better if it came to that, no public option. It's better to have a bill than not to have one. But I think there will be some kind of public option, even if it's with the proviso that states can opt out, which is one thing that's being considered. The notion of there being a trigger, that there's no public option until we see down the road if costs are being held down and then something would kick in, I think it's less desirable and less likely to pass. So I think that there's going to be some form of public option.
And it really is necessary, don't you think, in terms of going into the midterm elections and for the president to have a success here?
Oh, I think absolutely, and it's necessary for the country. I think the one thing the debate has brought out is how many horrible things are there in the status quo. I mean, start with the you know, the whole situation that if you have a previous condition and you get denied coverage. I mean, both I think Republicans and Democrats have denounced that, but that's the reality we've lived with for all these decades. And then there are various other things that are, you know, clearly everybody agrees has to be done.
Right. Jobs. Did anything come of the summit last week?
Focuses attention on this very important, you know, issue in the changing nature of our economy. We've got to create more jobs. And, of course, we're in this, you know, we're still in this recession. At least in terms of jobs, people may quibble about the definition of whether it's still a recession, but a lot of jobs have been lost. Unemployment is hovering around 10%. It's just below 10% now. But that's, talking about the midterm elections down the road, I think that's a very important part of it for the Democratic majority. Mm-hmm. They're going to need to impress upon the country that we're doing well economically.
Do you think that a second stimulus is in order?
Well, we've run up this tremendous deficit in debt as a result of all these issues that have had to be confronted. So I just not sure that we have the money to do it. But I don't know. I defer to the economists on that.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. It's All Things Political for this Monday, December 7, Pearl Harbor Day, and we would like to hear from you. We brought up the three major issues, Afghanistan, and we are looking at jobs, and we're looking at health care reform. Second hour of our show will be devoted to climate change with a conference on climate change starting today in Copenhagen. So join us. Our number, 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open for you right now. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Professor Lamis, starting with Mike from Appleton. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Professor, don't you think it would be more constructive if the president, whichever president it happened to be, came out and just said in simple terms, look, it's not Afghanistan, it's not Iraq, it's not Iran, it's not Pakistan, it's the region. And we're going to have to be in that region for two reasons. One, to maintain stability of the world oil markets, and two, to prevent nuclear weapons, which Pakistan has, from falling into the hands of some terrorist group who would use them. So we're going to be there. We're going to be there for the foreseeable future. If they came out and said it as simply as that, people would understand it and would be behind it, it seems to me.
Well, I think it's generally understood that we have vital national interests in the region and that we will be a presence there. But whether we will be and caught up in this kind of situation we are in Afghanistan now, and we're trying to extract ourselves from in Iraq, basically being occupying military forces is another question, and I think that's I think our national policy is to end both of those involvements and then to be ready to bring whatever pressure is needed on these other issues that you raise, so the oil question and Pakistan's nuclear weapons possibly falling to terrorists. These things could be dealt with without an occupying force in a couple of countries.
Thanks, Mike, very much for your call. John from Prairie du Chien is next. Hi, John.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the comment that I have is your guest made the comment that everybody is in agreement that something needs to be done about the health care, because the reason that he uses one of the examples is that everybody or people are being denied coverage because of pre-existing conditions. And I think the point that we're forgetting is that health insurance is a private industry, and they have the right to either accept people or deny them. I mean, this is not a government-given right to have health care. So I'm not sure why we're driving this by saying it's everybody's right when this is a private industry-driven service.
Well, I think you're coming to the core of the issue that everyone is debating is what is the role of private insurance in this field, and a lot of people are uneasy about it because health insurance is a little different than homeowners insurance or auto insurance. People can agree that health is something different, and everybody needs to be healthy if you can or have access to care. And so the conflict becomes when a profit-making operation is basically running the insurance part of it, and their goal is, of course, to make a profit. But people want to be healthy, so they don't really care about whether the insurance companies are making a profit. This is what's led a number of people in the left wing of the Democratic Party to say, let's get the profit motive out of it altogether and have Medicare for all, which is politically not feasible today, but maybe the debate down the road if whatever fix is done now doesn't work.
Okay, I just wanted to make that comment. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks, John, for the call. Lines are open at 800-486-8655. Paul from La Crosse. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Just two things that I caught sort of on as sidebars. Last week. One was the push by the Obama administration to remove lobbyists from the congressional, or I should say federal advisory panels. There's every group has got an advisory panel. The Defense Department has many of them, and each congressional committee seems to have an advisory panel. And these are made up of mostly industrial leaders and academia and things like this, so they get the best information possible. But they've become a dumping ground for lobbyists, so that people who have a vested interest in the outcome of a committee will be advising that committee on what they ought to be doing. Now, these lobbyists are leaving, so that first part is like, how significant, when can we, if you've heard about this, when can we expect to see some results on this? Because personally, I think it's a great idea. And the other one was tearing down this wall between federally funded stem cell and privately funded stem cell that the government is opening up a lot, and there's more money going into general stem cell research than before. And what effect, since Wisconsin had one of the stem cells that was approved for being used in studies, I'm wondering what effect this will have on Wharf and everything else going on at the UW.
Excellent questions, both of them on the stem cell issue. Kathleen, I'm just going to have to pass. That would make a good program for you.
Yes, it would.
But I don't know the details. And on the other point about the lobbyists off of these advisory boards, I also don't know the full details. But I do know that President Obama's campaign, in part, was based on doing something about the unsavory nature of the Washington system, and getting control of money in politics, and this is one area where certainly he needs to take action, and he apparently is taking action. I think I'd like to see down the road some very strong action on campaign finance control and other aspects of the unsavory nature of money in politics in Washington. And I think the president would have moved more quickly on it had he not had so many immediate challenges with the financial crisis and both of these wars and health care and so forth. Pretty busy, pretty busy agenda.
The figure I've heard, tell me if you've heard the same, that there are 6 lobbyists for every member of Congress, 6 per person from the health care field, from the health insurance field.
Just the health insurance field.
Isn't that something?
Well, that's astounding. I have a student this semester doing a senior project on lobbying, and particularly on the lobbying in this current healthcare reform effort.
Send him or her our way. We'd love to see that research. It'd be a good talk show, don't you think?
We don't have full information on exactly how much money is being spent, who's spending it, because people conceal this through different groups, innocuously named, and so forth. It takes some good investigative reporting, frankly.
Yes, exactly. Thanks, Paul, for your call. David from Stevens Point. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, what I wanted to pick up on was the discussion about the president's supposed failure of communication, and I don't think that's the problem. I think that the guest answered the question in talking about how this was a hard choice among difficult options. I think our problem is in the political culture. We need the maturity to face up to when we don't have good choices, we only have bad choices. The stimulus and deficit is another example. You know, we're in this mess because there's not enough demand, and unfortunately, you know, the government spending is the only option we have for generating demand.
I think that's exactly right. I mean that the choices are hard. I guess, you know, I hate to be critical of someone as politically skillful as President Obama, to want to get into office and then to be dealing fairly effectively with a lot of issues. But I listened closely to his speeches and administrative spokesmen and, you know, cabinet officers and all of that. And I would just like to hear more of the president talking directly to the public, you know, from the Oval Office, just in a conversational way. I think is when you have a large audience and you're delivering a speech, you know, different rules of rhetoric come in, and that you want to make, you know, important points to an audience, and I think you lose some of that that you would get just the president talking directly to the camera, that is to the viewer.
Thank you, David, for your call. Mitch from Green Bay. Hi, Mitch.
Hello.
Hello.
I have the thing that, you know, the health insurance program was started to help employers get scarce employees, and it even got larger during World War II. Because they needed the employees to work in different areas, and these things enlarged from there. And the healthcare system not only competes against other employers to get the employees to that employer, but also competes against the uninsured for the medical limited medical facilities that are available, and they compete against all of us who aren't insured by them.
Our system, you know, clearly started, as you said, as a kind of a haphazard way to deal with this problem through the employers, and that's been, you know, that's been very, very effective for vast majority of the country, people who are employed, but we have all these millions who are uninsured, and they get coverage because by law they're entitled to go to the emergency room. And as a humane society, you know, thank goodness we at least have that available. But that, as you know, that skews the whole system, because those who do have insurance are really picking up the tab for the uninsured. So that's one of the major goals in this healthcare reform effort. And it, you know, when you step back from it, you think about it, it's really remarkable that people are finally taking this on, because most of those uninsured people are not politically or necessarily closely following politics. They may not be those who participate very regularly. In other words, there may not be a lot of votes in it, but it's important that we have a better system. Who knows when one of us will be unemployed, one of your family members will be without insurance. I don't know if I completely got to what you were getting at, but that's my first reaction.
Right. It is true, there but for the grace of God go I. It's just a matter of losing your job, and, ooh, my, you could face all kinds of problems.
Yeah, it's hitting all people of all incomes. You know, you may have an upper middle class family, but they've got grown children who are out there trying to get started in their lives and their employment careers. They may have a job for a few years and then lose it, and they're too old to come under the insurance of the father and mother. So it's really everybody. We all live with it, and we have for many years. And I think there are a lot of provisions in what's being considered in the House and the Senate that will make this a much better system. It won't be perfect.
We speak on Pearl Harbor Day. I just like for a moment, because I think about this day. It changed so many lives in this country. So many people were motivated to fight for their country, and some never made it back. I'm thinking about today what it was like to have been alive and how your life changed so dramatically as a result of today.
Absolutely, yeah. Amazing. My parents lived through it. I was born some years after that, but only five years after Pearl Harbor, but it certainly changed their lives and everyone, and the country's role in the world. You know, before our involvement in the Second World War, I mean, it was never the majority sentiment in this country to be entangled with other nations, and since then, of course, we have a lot of international involvement. First, we had to confront the Cold War, of course.
Right.
I mean, in a sense, you know, talking about Pearl Harbor Day, in a sense, our Pearl Harbor was, of course, 9/11, and we're still living with the consequences of that. I think it is appropriate to compare the two.
Living with the consequences and not still knowing how to respond to that kind of attack, right?
Right. Well, because it was not an attack just from a nation state. That was, fairly straightforward. We were at war with Japan right after Pearl Harbor, and then the Germans and the Italians didn't waste much time declaring war on us. A couple of days, and then we were off. But this is a very different kind of war, and we're obviously going to be dealing with these terrorist threats for a very, very long time. But whether the best way to deal with them is to have hundreds of thousands of troops in countries in the Middle East is really a questionable, I think, solution.
What's a better way to deal with them, Professor Lamas?
Well, I think probably in the way we are dealing with it, and a lot of things are not known to the public. A lot of our covert efforts to thwart the terrorists, and that's appropriate. I mean, we can't know, we don't want to know, because if we as a public know everything about the secret efforts to counter the terrorists, of course the terrorists would know, and so we don't want that. But I think. We'll just have to continue, and it's not just us, because the attacks have occurred in Europe, they've occurred in Indonesia, and the Philippines. This is something that the global community has to deal with. I think we'll get past it. I mean, we got past the anarchist threats, 100 years ago. Those were, in, to some extent, similar to what we face today, the mindless terrorist activities.
And what do you think about the global community's response when we asked for help this last go-around? We got 7,000 troops additional from NATO. That seems like a minuscule number to me.
Well, that goes along with, of course, what the troops NATO already has there. And so, NATO, I mean, this war in Afghanistan is a NATO operation. It's the first NATO war since NATO was started. But it's hard to gauge completely. I mean, we get a lot of rhetorical support from our NATO partners. I mean, I heard a lot of that last week. But the burden falls mostly on us.
We go to Charles next from Illinois. Hi, Charles.
Good morning, Kathleen and guests.
Hi.
I just returned from Texas. They're talking about Obama spending so much money, they're going to succeed from the nation.
Right.
I know that in 2008, the Congress passed, I thought it was $700 billion, and I hear it was $800 billion on the second try. The first time they turned it down, But then they're saying Obama is spending more than the 08 Bush Congress. How much money, how many billions have we put into the stimulus? I've lost count. Did Obama's Congress put another $700 billion in? I'm just very confused about this.
Well, I don't have full command of those numbers either, but they are very large. There's no question about it. And some of the reason that the numbers shock us is that this administration put our wars on the budget, and so they're not concealed. So we immediately saw a huge jump in the deficit as a result of this, which you might call honest bookkeeping. But I think related to what you're saying is there is in the country, I think, a building backlash to all the money we spent to bail out the financial institutions. You're hearing it, all around. People are mad at the financial institutions. Shorthand for that is Wall Street. They're mad at Wall Street for getting us into this mess, and it's a delayed kind of anger. I mean, I think it's growing, but related to it, of course, is what you just said about all the other expenditures that are going on, but many of them were necessary.
Do you have any idea, Professor Lamas, how much of that bailout money has been repaid?
No, but I really don't. But I think we should. Demand that be known, and there's another case where honest, straightforward conversation from either the president or the Treasury Secretary on these questions would be useful. Just lay it out for people. People want to know,
right?
And I guess if you spend many days investigating this topic, maybe you could figure it all out. But it should be presented clearly.
And what about Texas leaving the union?
Well, I was born in Charleston, South Carolina, where the first shot in the Civil War was fired. And I think we settled that issue of states leaving the union. So.
But it can still be discussed, right? The threat can always be there. Hey, we're going to leave. Yeah, I was just thinking about that, wondering how the United States would be different if we didn't have Texas.
Right.
I don't know. Let's welcome more phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. It's All Things Political, as it always is on Monday at 9 o'clock. And Professor Alexander Lamas is our guest, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we will be talking about climate change, the 2-week conference in Copenhagen beginning today, and something like, how many newspapers is it? I got the story here somewhere, but I can't remember where it is. 56 newspapers all over the country are running the same editorial today, which I think is interesting. We'll talk about that. We'll have two guests with us. Climate change, hour number two. Let's go to Mike from South Milwaukee. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen. I tuned in late and just caught the gist of the conversation. But my comment is I would encourage Wisconsin Public Radio listeners to read a recent article in the current Rolling Stone magazine by Matt Taibbi, who discusses the Wall Street bailout, the financial collapse, and the engineers of both the collapse and the bailout, basically proteges of Robert Rubin, who are still in power in the White House. It's an absolutely fantastic article. And the people that caused this problem, Rubin, his proteges, are still in power, among them Larry Summers. So I'd encourage people to read the article.
Yeah, my husband gave that to me last week and said, read this. And I said, okay, Mike, I'll do that, but I haven't done it yet. So
yeah, it's a great article.
Okay, maybe we can get the author on that as well. And did you see, at a totally unrelated thing, except that his father, his father is the NBC reporter who did this incredible story that was on last night about orangutans who are taking pictures, but elephants who can draw pictures of elephants, too. That's unrelated, but his dad's a great reporter as well. Professor Lamas.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know if you've read the article.
That, by the way.
You did see it?
No, I didn't.
Oh,
I didn't.
It was quite captivating.
Yeah. But I didn't, and I didn't know about the Rolling Stone article. But there is a burgeoning literature of books and other things on what happened. And as I say, I think there's a lot of public anger, and it's not going away until we get answers or we get some details on the question, Kathleen, you raised a minute ago, which is how much of that money's been paid back. You know, how much did we lose as taxpayers?
At the risk of being too simplistic about this, but I'm wondering, is it the same old, bailing out Wall Street, that Wall Street has way too much influence, that we got the same cast of characters who've been around for many administrations, and they get their way?
No, I don't, I mean, I think on maybe one level, there's certainly an elite, and they in this policy area, and they know each other. But on the other hand, we did have an important election, and this president has very different priorities than President Bush, and I think he'll be addressing this populist anger at some point. But he's also the responsible agent of government, and he doesn't want to rattle financial confidence at this point. But once we get to a point, I think, where things are much more stabilized, I look for some strong response.
Thank you, Mike, very much for the call and the suggestion. We'll try to get Mike on the show. That would be good. Dan from La Crosse. Hi.
Hey, before my question, I'll just remark that, quite frankly, I wouldn't mind seeing Texas leave the union. Then we wouldn't have been stuck with our previous president. So some of those states, I think we might be better off without them. But I'm curious what his guest's thoughts are on what's going to happen. I mean, I know it's a year away, and I think things can change a lot. But my feeling is the Republicans, an off-year election might do real well. But I think if the economy actually starts to turn around, things maybe could really backfire on him for being so negative. Is that a real chance? I don't know. I'm curious to know what his perspective is on that.
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. Let me just say I'm very fond of Texas. It's a wonderful state with a lot of diversity to it. And I think people have a stereotype of Texas, and when you're there, you see how different the various parts of Texas are, and so forth. So let's keep all the 50 states. Anyway, on the you raise the best issue about the election, and that is, that we don't know between those two outcomes you suggested which it's going to be. And I think anybody who's telling you that they know it will be a big surge for the Republicans or the other side, that the president will hold on and do well, they're just not telling you the truth, because we just don't know how this is going to play out with the public. And as you mentioned, we don't know the state of the economy, which is always very important in elections. I could see scenarios where it would be a strong election for President Obama, and then you can see another scenario too, that the Republicans would do well. They certainly have taken the position that they will oppose everything this president is doing on domestic affairs, and that's risky if people begin to see that the president is doing the right thing and come to that conclusion, and enough of them do.
You could also have a situation where not many people would vote. They don't like anybody, really.
Well, in the off-year election, there's no question that you will have a drop-off in turnout compared to presidential elections. I mean, we know this. You can plot this over 100 years, and you will see that in practically every off-year election. I might just mention, if you don't mind, a couple of books that I think are really worth reading at this point, and they're about the 2008 presidential election. I've just finished them. One is by Haynes Johnson and Dan Baltz on the 2008 election. It's a great overview, and you forget details even if you follow it closely. And the second one, I haven't gotten through it yet. I just started. It's by President Obama's campaign manager, mm-hmm.
David Plouffe.
I think it's called The Audacity to Win. And that has a incredible and fascinating detail. And it impresses upon you, what an amazing feat to win the presidency for a person with so limited national experience at that point. And basically the part I'm in right now is how they overcame all the advantages that then-Senator Clinton had and defeated her. It's quite a story, and he tells it very well.
He does, yeah. We had him on last week or the week before.
Oh,
it was
uh-huh.
a fascinating story. It was great. But it is true, if you think that you've got something and you don't work hard, you might lose it, right? She just didn't think that she was going to lose that.
They were a very... very much overconfident, and of course, and I'm sure Mr. Plouffe got this across in your talk with him. But the Iowa was the key,
right?
And they did, mm-hmm. and the Clinton people really didn't understand Iowa, partly because Bill Clinton didn't compete in Iowa in '92. Senator Harkin was in the race, and so he didn't enter Iowa, so they didn't have that experience with the Iowa caucuses.
It was Iowa.
It was not always Iowa. Sometimes the Iowa caucus winner doesn't go on to win.
But that's
an issue that you and I have talked about before, which is the wacky nature of the presidential selection process, and that it's still wacky, and I think needs reform. But that's that's another issue, and I don't think anybody wants to fool with that now.
Yeah, I used to think that too. Except when you go to Iowa, we went to Iowa, and to see how seriously, at least the people we talked to, took their jobs, I thought, okay, you guys are good.
Well, that's right, and New Hampshire too. But my argument is that, frankly, we should spread this around. We should have other states that are fairly manageable for campaigns, relatively small in population.
Makes sense.
Rotate and go first, and share this. First in the nation status.
Right. Just so long as it's not Texas, right? Just kidding.
Well, I think it is a problem with big states. It's just simply, it's just too hard to for candidates not well-known to get well-known quickly. So the way they did it last time, they had four relatively small states from four parts of the country go first, and that's a good, but I just think they ought to rotate it.
Thank you very much, Dan, for the call. We go to Patrick from Greenfield. Hello, Patrick.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'll consider it my birthday gift.
Today's your birthday?
Yeah.
Oh, Patrick, happy birthday.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
My comment is, I believe the professor is wrong about the public sentiment against the bailout and all of this stuff. This was well known before the last election. In fact, if anybody was paying attention, it was both the last president and the two contenders, Republican and Democrat, for president, and all of Congress were in agreement that we must have TARP and we must have bailout of Wall Street, which has turned out to be abysmal. And I followed the logic of Ralph Nader, that there was plenty of money to be had to pay for all this through Wall Street itself by taxing the derivatives, which is out of hand and unchecked and unregulated. But no one seems to be interested in really reeling in all of the characters on Wall Street. And as far as the American public goes, they're really the centerpiece of why all of this keeps going on. We're depending upon the people we put into Congress to regulate all of the lobbyists and all of the interest, which really drives what gets done in Washington. And it's like asking Congress, which is really like a heroin addict, to draft legislation enforcement rules to stop the flow of heroin. It just isn't going to happen.
Well, that's I think that's why we mentioned 20 minutes or so ago about the importance of reining in the influence of money in Washington and in the Congress, and particularly through campaign finance reform and other mechanisms. But you're certainly right that it hasn't been done, and that the system has serious problems. But in terms of everyone supporting the bailout right back in October of last year, it was, from everything I've heard, it was absolutely necessary to prevent a financial collapse. But the populist anger that I'm talking about is not so much directed at that one activity, but directed at what's happened since and how we should punish the people who were responsible in some way. I don't know about that taxing scheme you mentioned, but there's certainly a lot that ought to be done, and people are really angry about it.
Thank you, Patrick. We go to Jeff from Eau Claire. Hello, Jeff.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I think that last caller is going to hate my idea, but I heard an idea on from David Brooks, I think it was, either him or Mark Shields. It was on Friday on the Lehrer Report, and he mentioned a five-cent tax on gas to support our fighting men and women, and I support that. I just called my congressman to tell him about it.
I actually heard that, too, on the Lehrer News Hour. You know, there's just a lot of opposition to raising gas taxes. People, it hurts a lot of, you know, hurts a lot of people who don't have ability to deal with it, and it hurts truckers, independent truckers, and others. But some kind of tax, I think, is certainly would be in order. And I don't know how you'd craft it. You know, the previous caller mentioned some, you know, a tax on these derivatives and so forth, which are apparently still on the books. I don't know how that would be done. Of course, it's easy to always say, well, tax the very wealthy. And as a good QE loan Democrat, I would be in favor of that. But, but there, you know, the whole notion of sacrifice that they were talking about on that program is, I think, right. We should feel some pain in these wars.
Well, then it would make sense to tack on another 5 cents for global warming, right?
If you're in favor of raising the cost to gasoline, you know, but that's going to be your topic next hour.
Exactly. Thanks, Jeff, for the call. We go to Mary from Brookfield. Hello, Mary.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a comment because of the right that people feel that health care is not a right, but if we can't educate people and we can't work unless we're healthy, and I feel that it's a right that that the American people should have, and at least for basic health care, and I just wondered what you thought about that.
Absolutely, that's what I think. I think it's the humane approach for our public policy, and we have a lot of examples around the world of countries we consider on our level of development that have gone that route and have been there, in fact, for many decades. It's not to say that there are not a lot of difficult choices to be made. Of course, there's the whole issue of cost containment and other things. But we should start with that fundamental, that health care is a right for every American.
Do you think we're going to get something significant, Mary?
I'm sorry?
Do you think we will get significant health care reform?
Well, I'm praying.
You're praying.
I've been in the medical field, and my family is, and the stories are just horrendous. And I just don't see how they, you know... I don't know how our congressman can just remain blind to this. I do wonder, I think the professor commented that he didn't think Medicare, like extending Medicare, would work. Did I understand that right?
I don't think it's politically feasible. The votes just aren't there, even though there are a lot of members of Congress who do favor that. They're just not a majority.
Mm-hmm. I think it's called the Conyers Act or something. Maybe that's by the wayside a long time ago. But, I mean, it seemed that was pretty much the premise of that, is that to use Medicare as a basis and then bring in first, like, the older, the level of age group just below Medicare and then gradually bring that in. But... it seemed very logical.
Well, it is logical and sensible. When, in fact, when Medicare was passed in 65, there was, you know, some fear that because you were taken out of the problem, a large segment, the elderly, that this would set back total national health care reform. And in fact, that argument, you know, was proven to be true. It's been many years now.
But yet their majority of the people like it. So.
Thank you, Mary.
No, oh, yeah, they do. Oh, Medicare, I think, is very popular.
Professor Lamis, thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Alexander Lamis, our guest this hour. He joins us from time to time for all things political. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. We thank him for his time. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. And thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. And thank you for listening, everybody. News is coming up from National Public Radio, and we will talk about what certainly is the story of the week, if not the next 2 weeks, around the world, climate change. So stay with us here on the Ideas Network.